Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. We're talking to Moshe Adler. He teaches economics at Columbia University and at the Center for Labor Studies at Empire State College in New York, and he's the author of the new book, Economics for the Rest of Us, Debunking the Science That Makes Life Dismal. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let's start with the idea of economics as a science with laws. Is it a science the way physics is a science?
Well, I don't think that it is, and I don't think that it can be, really. And that is because economics is a field that teaches us or tells us how to judge government policy. And as a matter of fact, there isn't even one policy that has only winners and no losers. Every policy has both winners and losers. And so even education that everybody agrees that we need, if you want better education, that means that somebody will have to pay for it. And usually if we have both rich and poor, it will mean that the rich have to pay more for the poor and perhaps even pay a little bit subsidy towards the children of the poor. So every policy always has winners and losers. So you can never say about a policy whether it's a good policy or a bad policy, you can only say whether it will be good for these people or good for these other people.
Well, you observe at the beginning of the book that when economists are talking about what's good for the economy, they're usually talking about what's good for the wealthier classes, but they're not talking about how something that affects the economy affects the poor or the middle classes. Why is that?
Well, because, like I said, I mean, the reason is really historical, and I think it is also a question of where the political power is. But you cannot talk, there isn't such a thing as an economy. There are only people, and the people who live inside an economy, inside a country, inside a place, are divided mainly in today's world between, say, rich and poor. So when you say that something is good for the economy, then you have to ask, who is the economy? Is the economy the rich or is the economy the poor? And we know that historically when we had a monarchy, this problem did not exist. I mean, it is known that Louis XIV said, and pardon my French, l'état est moi, I am the state. So if you want to know what is good for France, well, your task is very simple. Ask yourself what is good for the king, and voila, you know what is good for France. But once you have a democracy and the government becomes the government of the people, the question becomes, who are these people? Are they the rich or are they the poor? Because you cannot serve both the rich and the poor at the same time with the same policy. So part of the reason that economists choose sides is that any time that you recommend a policy, you must choose sides. You don't have a choice in the matter. Policy either will be good for this class, or it will be good for the rich, or it will be good for the poor. It cannot be good for everybody at the same time. So economists have actually made a choice, and they chose the rich, but it wasn't always like that.
Well, I have a question. There are certainly many people who would argue that, what's the term they use? A rising tide raises all boats. That there are economic phenomena that are good for everybody. That's not true?
I am not sure that we see it. I mean, what happens is that over the last 20 years, what is called the gross domestic product in the United States has increased every single year, but at the same time, we know that the conditions of working families have deteriorated. The median wage has fallen. Families that had one working person now have two working people, and both of them together cannot make ends meet. But furthermore, the question is, when you say that the tide, a rising tide, what does it mean, a rising tide? How do we measure what the size of the economic pie is? And what I show in my book is that actually the distribution of income determines the size of the pie. And in a strange way, you can find the way that economists measure the pie, you can find that the pie is growing while it is feeding a fewer people. And I'll give you a simple example. The example is, for instance, of AIDS drugs. What happens is that people with AIDS in the United States can afford much higher prices for AIDS drugs than people in Africa. So the drug companies are letting millions of people in Africa die of AIDS. Why is that? Because they cannot afford the high prices. Now, the cost of producing these drugs is minuscule, and had they been charged only the cost of production, Africans would have been able to afford these drugs. But when some people are rich and some people are poor, then the drug companies find it actually that it's better to restrict, to produce fewer drugs that will save fewer people, because they can make money this way by selling only to the rich. And lo and behold, what happens is that when the prices of these drugs are high, actually the way that we measure the gross domestic product, we find that it has increased because we are producing goods of high value. But if we were selling the same drugs at a low price that everybody can afford, it is entirely conceivable that we would have measured the GDP that is smaller. So the problem is that inequality interferes time and again in how much is being produced, and less is being produced that we have the capacity to produce.
In the example that you just gave, why don't they sell for a higher price in one country and for a lower price in the other country and make even more money?
Right. This is because they are afraid that if they sell it at low prices in Africa, then either AIDS patients in the United States will themselves travel to Africa to buy the drugs in Africa, or somebody will come between them, meaning somebody will find a way to make a buck by buying the drugs in Africa and selling them illicitly in the United States for a low price. So if they could do that, they would, and then people in Africa would have not died, but they can't, so they don't. But the problem is rampant. I mean, we now know that, for instance, rock stars decrease substantially the number of rock concerts, the live rock concerts that they give, and not because they are reluctant to work so hard or to appear so many nights. They appear as many nights as before, but the New York Times tells us that they now prefer to appear in very small parties that, say, a corporation gives or a wedding or something like that. There are wealthy people who are able to buy a performance by Elton John or by Paul Simon or anybody like this. So these guys now are just doing private parties, and the rest of us don't get to hear them in the large venues. So they do work, and the capacity is there, but they just choose to serve a smaller market, the market for the rich, of the rich, rather.
We're talking to economist Moshe Adler. So you examine in the book two principles in economic theory: efficiency, first of all, and the determination of wages. Let's start with efficiency. What do economists mean when they say the free market is efficient?
Well, basically they say that the free market is efficient because the free market lets the rich consume to the heart's desire. If you put a limit on what the rich can consume, this is inefficient. But if you let them consume to the heart's desire, this is efficient. So, again, an example. You are actually calling me in New York City. In New York City, we have a problem that large apartments are getting far larger, and small apartments are getting smaller. What I mean by that is that square feet, the area of apartments of three bedrooms and more, is increasing, has been increasing over the last 15 years, whereas the size of apartments of two bedrooms or less, one bedroom and a studio, is decreasing. And why is that? This is because the rich simply like more space and more rooms at the same time. And we also find that an apartment, the same apartment, if it has more bedrooms in it, then each square foot will fetch a higher price. So as a result, developers find out that they are better off building very large apartments instead of many small apartments. So we have really some unique apartments in New York. For instance, we have a new building called the Time Warner's Building with a huge, huge footprint, and apparently somebody there, it appears like from the newspapers, a single man even, bought two whole floors in this building, thousands upon thousands of square feet. And how does one man or a family, it was not clear, live in on two floors? What happens is that this person likes high ceilings, so they knocked out the ceiling of the lower floor. So what happens is that there is more space for the rich. The rich take more space. There is less space for the rest of us.
So that it's a great example. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, the rich houses are getting bigger, the poor houses are getting smaller. But how is that efficient? I thought economic efficiency meant you could produce more goods, more services, without using more resources.
That is not what economic efficiency means. What it means is, what it says is that if you have a rich person who wants to buy an apartment and a poor person who wants to buy it exactly the same apartment. The rich person is willing to pay for this apartment $1 million, and the poor person can afford to pay for this apartment $100,000. Suppose that the government intervenes and say by a housing control law says that this apartment goes to the poor person who can only afford for it $100,000, then economist says giving the poor person this apartment that they quote-unquote value at only $100,000 is inefficient for the following reason. Suppose that they were given this apartment and now they also had the right to resell it to the rich person. So the rich person would come to them and say, here is $500,000 for the apartment. And the poor person would sell it. And when the poor person sells them the apartment, both the rich and the poor will be better off. So what happens is that if we come to the poor person and I say, this is your apartment, but you cannot resell it, we have an inefficiency, because had we let the poor person sell the apartment to the rich person, both would have been better off, but the apartment would have ended up in the hands of the rich person. Now, here is an important step. All right. But the fact of the matter is that when the government intervenes to give the apartment to the poor person and not to the rich person, the government would always say, we are giving you this housing, but it's not for you to sell. You can live in it, but you cannot sell it. All right? On the other hand, we can have a totally free market. In a totally free market, the poor person will not have the apartment. Only the rich will have apartments, and the poor will not be able to have apartments. Which situation is better? The one in which the poor person has an apartment. Not all poor persons will have apartments, but the poor persons will have a chance to have some apartments. Or a situation in which the rich take all the apartments. Economists say that the latter is preferred because this is the efficient allocation of resources. So the market is efficient and any government intervention is inefficient, and economists absolve themselves from the question, all right, the market is efficient and the market government intervention is inefficient. What will happen to the poor if we do what you say? Economists say this is a political question, it's not our question.
So just, I mean, I don't want to stay on this for too long, but the question of efficiency, does it not, I mean, just looking in the dictionary, you know, performing or functioning in the best possible manner with the least waste of time and effort, and there are economic correlations of that too. So you can have an efficient production facility or an efficient farm or something like that, where you find innovative ways to use resources in a more efficient manner. Does that not figure into the equation of efficiency?
It does, but it cannot, it is one factor that does figure in, but it cannot be the whole factor. I mean, the problem is complicated. Suppose that the economy produced only one good, and the best way to produce this good was such that all the units of this good ended up in the hands of one person, and everybody else went literally starving and perhaps dying. Would this be economically efficient? Economists say yes, because in their definition, there is no consideration of what happens actually to the members of society. They are just interested in the number of the units of the good that have been produced. Okay, so this is efficient regardless of what happens to people. This is on the one hand. But on the other hand, I want you to permit me to go back for a second. Actually, the distribution of income itself determines what it is that is being produced. The thinking in the dictionary or in the econ book, actually, about how do we produce the most does not take into consideration the fact that what we produced is determined by the distribution of income itself. If we produce for the rich, then we produce huge apartments that sell for very high prices, and because these huge apartments sell for very high prices, we count it as if, with the free market, we produce the most goods. Because when the dictionary talks about producing the most units, it is not units that we are talking about, it is value. Because an economy, unlike my example, does not produce just one good. An economy produces many goods, so you have to aggregate them. And you aggregate them by their prices. So an apartment of 20,000 square feet, one apartment, 20,000 square feet, that sells for $20 million is more goods than 20 apartments of 1,000 square feet each that sell for only $500,000 each, because they go to poor people. So $500,000 is not poor, but it's poorer. Right, right. So what happens is, with 20 apartments, we will have a product of $10 million, and with one apartment, we will have a measurement of $20 million. So we will have to say that the one apartment is more, and therefore letting the rich buy this apartment produce ends up with more production than if we had 20 apartments of $500,000 apiece.
Okay, so this explains a couple of things. It explains, for example, here in Santa Fe, why it is that we can have a large number of extremely expensive houses but a shortage of affordable houses.
Right.
And it explains how
An economist would say that this is efficient.
Right, they would say that this is efficient. And it explains how we can be in a situation right now, or perhaps it does, you tell me, of huge CEO bonuses, a rally on Wall Street, but ordinary people losing their jobs and having a really hard time making ends meet, and it's called an improving economy.
I think you hit the nail on the head. The chief economist the president has, the chief economic advisor, his name is Larry Summers. He already in December announced that the recession was over. Now, how can the recession be over when people are continuing to lose their homes, and when the unemployment is 10%, and if you put in the discouraged workers, it is 17%. It's almost one out of five people who want to work full-time are unemployed, and yet the recession is already over. There is a disconnect there between what economists think of a well-functioning economy and the rest of us. And this is why I called my book, Economics for the Rest of Us, there are two ways of thinking of what the economy is. One of them is that the economy is the rich, and what's good for the economy is what's good for the rich, and it's time for us to think of what's good for us.
Just as an aside, there was a very painful example of that that was told to me by a friend of mine who is a nurse, and she said that one of her patients suffered complications of a carcinoma because she couldn't get an appointment with her dermatologist because the dermatologists were too busy doing facelifts.
This is true, and the amazing thing that I actually tell in the book is precisely about the fact that economists claim that health insurance is actually inefficient, because what happens is that the chief economics advisors to President Reagan, his name was Martin Feldstein, he is a professor of economics at Harvard, and in 2004 he was the president of the American Economic Association, and he devoted his presidential address then in 2004 to health insurance. And you would think that the president of the American Economic Association will talk about how do we make health insurance affordable to everybody, but in his talk he talked about exactly the opposite, how it is inefficient to make it affordable to everybody, because what happens is that suppose that the doctor's visit costs $100 and you don't have $100 to pay the doctor, then you don't go to the doctor. According to economists, why don't you go to the doctor? Because you don't value the visit at $100. Now comes insurance and say that your copay is $25 and you go to the doctor. Okay? So what happens is basically you are consuming, you're consuming something that costs society $100, which is the doctor's visit, which is worth to you only $25, and this is a waste. So Martin Feldstein, in his talk, was kind of tearing his hair out and proposing policies how to force people to buy insurance policies that have higher co-pays so that it will prevent them from going to the doctor. On the other hand, cosmetic surgery is the prime example of medical care that is efficient, and the reason that it is efficient is because a person will not buy a facelift for $10,000 without paying it for it out of their pocket. And the reason for that is that it's not covered by insurance. That means that I only buy it when I value it at more than the cost. Well, the rich, they value it more than $10,000, therefore they buy it. Therefore, it is efficient. But your friend would not have been able to pay the doctor for a visit, whatever it would have been, say $5,000 or whatever, then to let her do that would have been inefficient.
Part of the healthcare question right now concerns the reality that when you treat people early on and do preventive care and things like that, that they don't get sick as often and therefore they use less healthcare. Wouldn't that be considered efficient?
That would be considered efficient by, I think, any definition of efficiency. This would not violate, because once we have insurance, if I have to treat you when you are sick and you have to treat me when I am sick, then there is something that economists call an externality, and I am better off paying for you to take the treatment now rather than treat your sickness later.
We're talking to economist Moshe Adler. His new book is called Economics for the Rest of Us. Now, you write in the beginning of the book about the British philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who gave us the idea of utilitarianism. What is utilitarianism in terms of economics?
What utilitarianism says is that when one person has many dollars and one person has few dollars, then if you take a dollar from the rich and give it to the poor, the rich will suffer a loss of a dollar. The poor will gain a dollar, but in terms of the utility that they derive from this dollar, the rich will suffer a little loss of utility, and the poor will gain a lot of utility simply because the poor needs the dollar more than the rich does. So if you think about the dollar as giving you utility, then utilitarianism says that the utility that the poor will derive from a dollar is less than the utility that the rich will lose from paying a dollar.
When I read that, I was thinking, okay, so if you are poor and you get a dollar, each additional dollar you get buys you food, shelter, clothing, healthcare, and so on. But after a while, the more dollars you get, the more you're buying things that don't make so much of a difference, like more clothes or
right.
lots of gadgets.
Right.
And that can eventually even decrease your happiness by taking time away from more important things like human relationships and whatnot. Whereas when you're poor, each dollar really does buy happiness.
Right. And this is why Bentham thought that utilitarianism shows that what the government should do is redistribute income from the rich and give it to the poor. But there was an Italian economist by the name of Vilfredo Pareto, who at the beginning of the 20th century said that what Bentham said was not necessarily true. He didn't say that Bentham was necessarily not true, not right. He didn't say that Bentham was necessarily wrong, but he said that it could be that he sometimes was wrong. And what he said is, he gave the example of a wolf and sheep, and he said that the wolf wants to eat the sheep, and the sheep don't want to be eaten, so how can a government do anything that will improve the... In other words, basically, I mean, let's think about, say that the rich actually enjoy being rich, or they enjoy the suffering of the poor or something like that, that it could be that actually when they see their dollars go away to help the poor, they actually suffer not because they have less of anything, but they suffer simply because they see the condition of the poor improve. Now, Pareto never said that he thinks that that is the state of the world. He said that is a possibility, sometimes at least. And based on this argument, economist says, oops, Pareto is right, and from now on, we cannot advocate policies that are redistributive, because maybe when you take to the rich and give to the poor, the suffering that you cause the rich actually exceeds the benefit that you give to the poor.
That's sounds like insanity. I mean, almost nobody.
It does to me, and there was an economist by the name of Abba Lerner that said, well, of course, in theory, this is possible, but in statistics, it is a rule that when you roll a dice, it has six faces. If you're a gambler, the best assumption that you can make is that all the faces are filled, that the die is not weighed on one side, if you don't know that it is. If things appear the same, then the best assumption that you can make that they are the same. So Abba Lerner said that people are people, the rich and the poor are people, and of course it is possible that the rich are totally crazy in this particular way, but it is extremely unlikely. And because the rich and the poor, other than the money that they have, they appear like quite similar human beings, the best that we can do is to assume that they are the same. But cogent as this is, it didn't catch. And the reason for that is, in my mind, is simply because this idea that sound economics, I mean, the science of economics would consistently advocate taking from the rich and giving to the poor is not a science that, I mean, the poor don't hire economists, and no rich would hire an economist that would say, take from me, take from me. So that would have left, I'm afraid, would have left economists unemployed.
The second part of your book is about wages. How are wages determined? Why is it that some people make $8 an hour and some people working for the same company make $5,000 an hour, not including bonuses?
So this question was addressed by what are considered the first economists. I'm sure they are not the first, but nevertheless, Adam Smith and David Ricardo. And Adam Smith and David Ricardo believed that this is determined by the bargaining power that people bring to the table, and that the bargaining power itself, they couldn't really explain it. I'll tell you Adam Smith how he explained it in one second. But basically, their model was that production, I mean, you gave me in your question the example of a corporation in which there is a CEO working and a working worker working. Well, they say that this corporation produces automobiles. So this is an auto factory. So at the end of the year, this factory sold so many vehicles, and after you count the electricity and the raw material, but not labor, everything but labor, this factory has made a profit. Well, let's hope that he made a profit of $100 million. Now, this profit has to be divided between executives and between secretaries and between the janitor and between the person who put the right wheel in the car and the person who put the left wheel in the car, the person who put the hood, the person who built the engine, and so on and so forth. So what particularly Ricardo said about it is that production took place, happened by the team that included every person in this team, all these members of the team. And once they have the profit of the factory, then this has to be somehow divided. And this is divided by the bargaining power that each brings to the table. Adam Smith explained a little bit this bargaining power, and he said that this bargaining power is determined by the ability to hold out. So what happens is that the worker who has very few savings and cannot live unless she works, she must accept a low wage. Why? Because she cannot not work today. She cannot delay and looking for a better job and holding out and saying, I will not work for you unless you raise my salary. But a rich person can hold out and therefore will end up with higher pay. Adam Smith also talked about how the government actively makes it difficult for workers to unionize and helps employers put down workers and workers' demands. And what happens is that this was obviously a disturbing theory, and what happens is that in particular in this country at the end of the, or towards the end of the 19th century, there was a great, great, great labor unrest. And a particular case that maybe some of your listeners know about is the Haymarket Massacre in Chicago in 1886. And then there was a professor at Columbia, John Bates Clark, who wrote a book, and in the book he says that if workers are right that they are being exploited, then every person should become a socialist. So the job of the economist, he says, is to investigate, is it true that workers are exploited, or does every worker get the full value of what they produce? And lo and behold, in the same book, he developed a theory that, quote-unquote, shows that every person gets the value of what they produce. And Smith and Ricardo's theory was discarded, the same way that Bentham's utilitarian theory was discarded too, and it was replaced by a new theory of how wages are determined. And this new theory says that each person gets precisely not less and not more than the value of what they produce. So if you get $8 an hour, I know what it is, why it is. It is because you produce for your employer a product that has a value of $8 an hour. And if the CEO gets $10 million or $15 million a year, this is because she has produced for the employer $15 million worth of a product.
Well, besides the moral problems with that, in other words, keeping some people in poverty and giving some people wealth far beyond what anybody could possibly need, there is another problem with that, which is that if you form a union, or if you end slavery, or if you do some kind of collective bargaining, or if you lobby for government regulations of, for example, as we did here in Santa Fe, the so-called living wage, which is certainly not something that most people can live on, but it's better than it was before, then 5 years later, 10 years later, is that going to be considered what the value that person is producing? I mean,
well,
it
is worse than that, because what happens is that the economists like to talk about unions as being the aristocracy of labor. And why is it the aristocracy of labor? Okay, so remember that the theory is that the person gets paid exactly the value of what they produce. So if you get $8 an hour, that is because you produce a value of $8 an hour. Now, suppose that the union manages to squeeze a wage of $10 an hour out of the employer, okay? Now, here is a person who is producing $8 worth of value. This person will have to be fired. No employer is going to pay somebody $10 when they bring them in $8. So that means that every time that the union or the law gets to raise the wage, it is as if they are writing pink slips because they are firing people, because some people will have to be fired, because remember that the person who makes $8 an hour is worth only $8 an hour. Only that this theory that is so fantastically comfortable for employers has no empirical content. It is just not true, cannot be true, and this is because what happens is that if you say build a high-rise building, okay, and you have a contractor who makes a lot of money, and then you have somebody who operates the backhoe that digs the foundation, and another person pours the concrete, and another person builds the frame, and another person puts the glass in the windows, and another person puts the sheetrock, and I'm not going to go all over the list of everything that needs to be done. Suppose that the electricians get an increase in wage of $5 an hour or $10 an hour. Now we say, okay, the value of what they produce is not that much. Then now we are going to fire some electricians, and all of a sudden we will have a building without some of the electricity working, or some of the elevators not working, or if the backhoe operator gets erased, all of a sudden we will have a building without a foundation. This is silly. I mean, production is done by teams, and we cannot come and say this person produced this value and that person produced that value. Every person in the team is important. The team has produced something, and now this something has to be shared. The injustice that we have in nature too. I mean, we have something called the lion's share. I think that many people know that actually the lion has not produced anything at all, right? I mean, the lion doesn't do the hunting. It is the lioness that does the hunting. But he gets the biggest share. Why does he get the biggest share? Well, because he is the strongest. It's not because of what he has contributed to production. It is because out of what has been produced, he can take the biggest share. And what happens is that when we have people negotiating over how to divide what they have produced together, and one party is extremely powerful and the other party is extremely weak, then the party that is extremely weak needs the help of the government to overcome this weakness, because this is what the government of the people should do.
The help of the government or the help of their union.
This is true, only that Adam Smith was great in explaining how the strength of the union itself is determined by how the government treats it. What happens is that the ability of unions to organize workers is curtailed in many places by right-to-work laws and by forbidding this kind of picketing or that kind of picketing. Yes, I mean, yes, the unions can help workers, but how much help they can give and how strong that they can be depends on the law of the land.
We're talking to economist Moshe Adler. You give, speaking to this point, a very simple and easy to understand example in your book, which is that if you have a taxi and a taxi driver, and the owner of the taxi owns the car and he needs somebody to drive it, and between the two of them, that taxi brings in $100,000 a year. So how much does the taxi driver get paid? How much is his labor worth? How much is it worth to do the job versus to own and maintain the car? And that is something that doesn't have an answer. It's an answer that is negotiated by culture, by personalities, by the market and the other people out there. But there's not any scientific basis for that.
Right. You couldn't say, you could not, I mean, if after all the expenses and the maintenance, et cetera, the car and the driver together produce an income of $100,000 and the driver gets $25,000, it would be silly to say that this is the value of the product because that the driver herself produced, whereas the car herself produced $75,000. That would be silly because the car without the driver would have produced zero, and the driver without the car would have produced zero. Together they are a team, and what they have produced must be divided between them, but it cannot be divided. I mean, it cannot be determined by the process of production because we do not know what each has produced. By the way, I'm not the first one to say that at all. There was an economist that won a Nobel Prize, actually, by the name of Vasily Leontief, and he said that in 1941. He said that the theory that says that people get what they produce is silly because we cannot know what each person produces because they produce it in a team. He said it, made no difference. We continue to teach our students that people get the value of that, what they produce.
Well, I'm reaching back to college economics here, which was quite a long time ago, but if I recall correctly, the argument for keeping part of the profit, so the cab driver gets $25,000, the cab owner gets $75,000 for that one cab, which he didn't do, he maintained it, but he didn't drive it. And so the argument in favor of that, or keeping some proportion of that, is that they can not only maintain the taxi, but eventually buy a new taxi and then have two, three, and four. In other words, put it back into the business. And the reality is sometimes they do, and sometimes they buy diamond collars for their pet poodle and yachts.
What you just told me now is actually not in the econ book, but maybe it was in the hand of your econ professor, because I think that your econ professor was trying to convince you that it's okay for the owner to get $75,000, because the fact of the matter is that had the cab driver received a pay of $75,000, then there is nothing stopping her from buying the next taxi. So this is neither here nor there. I mean, the person who is the cab owner was not born with a sign on their forehead that says cab owner. I mean, they are cab owners because they have money. I mean, in New York City, to buy one medallion will cost you $350,000. So that is a lot of money. So if the cab driver was the one who is making the hefty side of this deal, then more cab drivers would have perhaps driven the cars that they own, and if they were truly very, very well paid, and then they would have bought themselves more taxis. If workers have more money, then they will be able to do everything that right now other rich people do. I mean,
what you're pointing to is that workers don't have the capital to start their own business, which is why they're workers. And that leads to the question of redistribution. I mean, part of what your book is about is, for both moral and economic reasons, redistribution can be a very good thing. What does redistribution of a nation's wealth actually look like?
What I emphasize in the book is that redistribution does not simply mean that you have the same pie and people who are getting, were used to getting a small slice are getting now a bigger slice. The pie itself changes with redistribution. Like I gave this example before of the AIDS drugs or the apartments in New York. I mean, there will be more apartments in New York. I have calculated, and I'm not sure exactly that I remember now the exact number, but I have calculated that if the size of apartments in New York City were limited to 1,200 square feet. I live with my family in a 900 square feet apartment, but if it were 1,200 square feet, of all apartments were 1,200 square feet, then you would have had something like an increase of 16% in the apartments for rent and 30% in the apartments for ownership without building one new building. In other words, if you only made all apartments of a reasonable size, then all of a sudden you increase the supply of apartments substantially simply because the rich love space so much. So redistribution means that we basically change what society produces, and the society starts producing what the rest of us need. I would start actually with laws that control wages and executive pay. I think that's good to start there. I mean, let's to begin with have a more equal distribution of the fruits of labor. And the rest we take care of through redistribution. But there is distribution that I think that we most need is not simply that you take a dollar from the rich and give it to the poor. I think the redistribution that we right now need is for the government to provide good public services. For instance, as we speak, instead of hiring more teachers, many, many school districts are having cuts. Public colleges have been increasing their tuition not only since the recession started, but they have been increasing their tuition over the last 10 years. We need a free public higher education. We need a social security system whereby somebody who retires at the age of 65 or 66 is able to live on it, so that we will not have to give our money to Wall Street for retirement. As we have seen with the current market, you can actually not count on this 401ks, etc. And we don't want it anyway. I mean, what we want is that we want to have a social security system such that you work all your life, you contribute all your life, and by the end of your life, you have something to live on. And we have right now millions, literally, I think that right now as we speak, about 5 million high school kids work while they go to high school, and they fill something like 3 million full-time jobs, the equivalent of 3 million full-time jobs. If we were to raise the wages of the parents, they will not have to work, and I would actually throw in child subsidies for families, because I think it's an abomination that high school kids have to work, because not all high school kids have to work, and those that work have a much lower chance of going to college. And once you're in college, you should get also a student subsidy, because education, we all know, is the wave of the future. So the redistribution that is most important to me is in terms of giving adequate government services. And that has to come, of course, from taxes.
So education, healthcare, pensions, and all that done through progressive taxation.
Well, I will not be offended if the taxation were not progressive. What happens is that even if we had a flat tax, the fact of the matter is that somebody was, if they say that the tax rate is 50% on everybody, then somebody who makes $10 million pays $5 million in taxes, and somebody who makes $40,000 pays only $20,000 in taxes. But if we have very, very, very good government services, which means that if the poor don't have to worry about savings for their kids' college education, if they don't have to worry about their own retirement, and if, when they are poor, their kids are entitled to child subsidies so that they don't have to work when they go to high school, etc., then even if the tax rate is flat, it is fantastically redistributive. So I think that the issue of whether the tax is progressive or not is a red herring. And I think that it does a lot of damage to our ability to tax when we all say tax only the rich. Tax, but not me. Taxes are good, but not me. I think that this is damaging. I think that it is very difficult to only tax the other guy. I think that we have to say we believe in taxes, including taxes on us, but when we get government services, we will be more than okay.
Moshe Adler is an economist at Columbia University and the Center for Labor Studies at Empire State College in New York, and his new book is called Economics for the Rest of Us. Thank you so much for being on the Radio Cafe with us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find me at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.